You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
Second City is back open for live shows, in-person classes, and customized corporate workshops and performances. But we also have all those things available in virtual formats. You can go online and find out all the information you need at secondcity.com. So today for the podcast, I'm talking to Mary Gaucher. She is a Grammy-nominated American folk singer-songwriter and an author whose songs have been covered by performers including Tim McGraw, Blake Shelton, and Jimmy Buffett. She's won a bunch of music awards, and she has a new book, which is called Saved by Song, The Art and Healing Power of Songwriting. I love talking to her. Enjoy the pod.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Mary Gaucher, welcome to the show.
Good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
You tell a story that in the first year you lived in Nashville, you were invited to a party that featured a song circle with, and this list is Guy Clark, Lyle Lovett, John Hyatt, Joe Eli, Steve Earle, and Nancy Griffith. I mean, that is like unbelievable. Can you tell us what happened and the gift that you got that night? The many gifts, but the one in particular?
Yeah, it's quite a song circle, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's kind of what you hope for when you move to Nashville,
right, at least.
If you're our age.
Yes, exactly.
I imagine youngsters might not even know who these legends are. But I think the thrill for me was being invited to play a song in that song circle. Mm-hmm. And it resulted in Nancy Griffith giving me her guitar, which had a mother of pearl engravement on the 12th fret in CG, which is her name, Nancy Claire Griffith. And she gifted it to me as a welcome to Nashville gesture, and also as a way of saying, this guitar has been good to me, but I think I've written all the songs it's going to give me, and maybe there's some in it for you. Here you go, kid. Good luck.
And that's a Nashville tradition to do that for?
That's what they said, or at least it was an old Nashville tradition. I think New Nashville is short on traditions and long on cash register delivery systems. But the old school was full of these respectful gestures to the mystery of creativity, and sort of a nod to the muse who's in charge of us all.
So I thought about that metaphor, and I think you can apply it to this book. I think this is you handing down your battered guitar to all of us, and indeed to young people, to sort of say, like, this journey hasn't been easy, but it's worth it, and here, you know, here's something to hold on to.
Oh, that's beautiful. And now you've given me the answer when people ask me, have I given my guitar to anyone?
Yeah,
that's the perfect answer. And yes, that is what I'm trying to do, is here's what I've learned over the last 30 years, take it or leave it. This has been my experience as both a person in recovery from addiction and a songwriter using the art form to help me not drown. It is a passing of a guitar, of a torch, of a folk singer's life lessons.
There's so many rich stories that we'll get to in the book, but I do want to dig into songwriting because that's so up the alley of this podcast, which is what happens when groups of people make something out of nothing, or individuals do that as well. And you say, quote, I learned to write songs by writing them. And by the way, like, you were a chef? That was how you entered this?
Yeah. I went to chef school. I found investors to open a small little takeout restaurant where we didn't cook. We bought and sold food, sort of a middle between, you know, muffin makers and soup makers. And we bought from them and resold to mostly people who worked at Mass General in Boston. Wow. And then my partners, investors, sent me to chef school, and we opened a full-service Cajun restaurant. All this happened in Boston in the 90s.
Yeah. And then you had a guitar before, but then I want you to talk a little bit about that process of, you explore a deep failure, you know, and open mics where you can't even perform, and you kept going. That seems unbelievable. I mean, we see so many young talent here have those same struggles, but you know, you really had a hard time at the beginning.
Oh my God, yeah. Stage fright feels life and death. When you're in it, it is a physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual experience that is absolutely terrifying. It feels like you're gonna die. And you know, I went to the stage later in life. I didn't have any experience. It looked so simple and easy from the audience, but you get up there and do it, especially older, having had another career. So I had to, you know, dust myself off, have a long talk with myself, calm down, and drag myself back there over and over and over again. Sometimes I still do, but mostly I've conquered it. That said, performing is a high risk experience. There's always the possibility of things going terribly wrong. That's the joy, and that's the beauty. It's also the fear of being on stage.
It's we did a project with Renee Fleming and Lyric Opera Chicago some years back, and Renee became a friend, and she actually had to stop touring for an entire year because of stage fright. And a few years back, she sang the national anthem at the Super Bowl. So I texted her afterwards to say, like, that was awesome. And she's like, can I talk to you? Because I thought that was terrible. And I'm just like, Renee Fleming, you're like the most beautiful voice like ever, and still suffers, you know. And so it doesn't matter how talented you are. The humanity is there, which is probably why artists like yourself and her create such incredible connection with communities of people.
Yeah, because I think we're genuinely vulnerable.
Yeah.
Which means we're afraid, but we're doing it anyway.
Yeah. The other thing that's interesting too is you write in the book, quote, "The more specific you get, the more universal the song becomes." I know that people are going to think that's backwards, but we know it isn't in our work as well. Things aren't funny when they're vague. And things certainly aren't true when they're vague. So you looked for these highly specific personal details as a way to make something open up to everyone, right?
Absolutely. And that's what I teach when I work with songwriters, is get specific and get deeply, deeply personal. I think songs are a place to tell your secrets. And I think that the deeper we can go, the more we're going to connect with people. This is the proper place to do this. And I think if nothing is revealed as you write, then if you don't surprise yourself writing it, then it's not going to be that interesting to the listener either. So I encourage songwriters to get more and more and more afraid of what they're writing, because that's where the vein of gold is, as Julia Cameron would say, the great artist way writer. It's universal, because we're all made of the same hopes, dreams, fears, and longings. And so to reveal yourself in a song in those categories is to show the listeners who they are too. We're all built of that same stuff at the core.
The other thing you talk about is reduction, right? This idea that also when you compress and you're putting this sort of like lovely weight on the fewer words that are there, which is something that we know. I mean, I think Shakespeare said brevity is the soul of wit. I mean, I think that that's actually another lesson that young songwriters probably don't know.
Yeah, that there's a whole chapter called Reduction, and I think I lead with it. That and my stunning fall from grace as I was arrested for drunk driving, but then got sober, which led to the whole story of the book. But yeah, I honestly go around a song 1,000 times and make sure every single word has to be there. If I can get a word out, it's out. Don't need adverbs, don't need a lot of adjectives, certainly don't have room for a lot of flowery language. Every time you take a word out, the words that remain become more powerful. Songs and music are a dearly, deeply compressed art form. You got 3.5 minutes to do what it takes a novelist 600 pages to do. You got no time for hemming and hawing and surface level cocktail party conversation. You got to get to the heart of it, and you got to get there quickly. And it's done often best through story. Story is told best when it's told with less words rather than more.
So I don't know if you know, Second City is located on Wells Street in Chicago, right across from what used to be the Earl of Old Town. And my dad was a longtime radio guy here and built up a relationship with John Prine over the years. So I saw Prine in concert a dozen times. And I mean, you know, what is there to say about that genius? Except I do want you to talk a little bit about that moment when you heard Sam Stone. Because that relates to this 1990 getting caught drunk driving, and then your, you know, how you move into the space of that eventually becomes a recovery.
Yeah, John, before I knew him, before I wrote songs, before I became an artist, John put out this record, Sitting on a Hay Bale, and it's one of the most classic of all classic records. And on that record were masterpieces, timeless masterpieces. And as a young person, I felt it. I saw John in the, I think, early 80s at LSU when I was in college there. He played the small student union. Mm-hmm. I saw John dozens of times before I opened for him and before I became a songwriter. Mm-hmm. And so the song Sam Stone really jumped out at me. Because I'm of the age where I knew veterans coming back from Vietnam. They were older than me, but I knew them. They drank at the same biker bar that I drank at. And so Sam Stone became the song I would play in the parking lot of the biker bar in Baton Rouge because that's what they wanted to hear. And it taught me everything I needed to know about songwriting. It also taught me everything I needed to know about songwriting with veterans. I didn't even have any idea I was going to be a songwriter, much less later in my career be paired with wounded veterans to help them articulate their story through song. But Sam Stone has, it's the instruction manual on how to do all of this. It's one of the greatest anti-war songs ever written, and it doesn't say anything anti-war. It just tells what happened to a wounded veteran.
Yeah, that opening line, there's a hole in daddy's arm where all the money goes. It's just, I can't, like, it does not get any better than that. That talk about specific and sparse and reductive. I mean, that is that's amazing. So let's talk about the work you did do with veterans, because that's very powerful. And that started what, like 2013? Is that when you got
something like that? Yeah. I've been at it for about seven, eight years now. Mm-hmm. What I do is bear witness to stories told to me by wounded veterans through a program called Songwriting with Soldiers, and turn their story into song. There is a number of retreat centers that we work at around the country, usually three songwriters, professional songwriters, masters songwriters, and six veterans. And every veteran that comes gets their own song. That is a reflection of their life experience, their story, the one that needs to be told. And God, I love the program. I put a record out of songs that I wrote over the years with vets. I think it contains 11 songs, and it got nominated for the 2019 Grammys in the folk category.
Yeah, and you got to play one of those songs at the Grand Ole Opry.
I did. I got to play it with one of my co-writer veterans, who's a harmonica player, at the 90th anniversary of the Grand Old Opry at the Ryman, which is awesome, the historic place that where the Opry began.
We work with behavioral scientists sort of in a program that looks at improvisation and the evidence of human behavior. And there's some very interesting studies that show that, you know, I think many of us think people want to be seen as their best selves, their smartest selves, that sort of thing. But interestingly, people want to be seen as they see themselves. That's the thing that scratches the itch, which I think is where the music gets at. You know, it isn't certain. The great music, the great songs are ones that get that layer deeper in terms of what's really going on in there that you and it feels like those when you tell the stories and the process of writing with these veterans, I mean, it's a process, but then they get there and then they open up to you. It feels like that's a place now where you can cry, you can hug. And whereas before, that one vet you talked about was really walled off and had to be sort of coaxed by the music.
Yeah, the music becomes a bit of a magnet to pull the story out. When I start playing the melody that matches what they feel, they are seen. They don't just feel seen, they are seen.
Yeah.
And that is profound for someone who carries trauma, because you feel so unseen. That's the nature of trauma, that what's happened to you is ineffable. There are no words. And so you can't tell somebody how you're doing, because you can't find the words, because there are no words. And then the music comes in and sees you. It is a powerful, powerful moment. And it can become a confessional. In these co-writes, the veterans many, many times say, my wife doesn't even know this about me, but I'm going to tell you, and I don't even know why. Of course, I know why, because I'm playing how they feel. You know, I often work with my songwriters in the workshops that I teach and tell them music is what feelings sound like.
You also shared trauma. I mean, then you were adopted, had sort of a screwed up, you know, adoptive parents. You're a queer kid growing up in the South. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on there that led to that. And then discovering later in life when you have a series of relationships that don't work, that you go to that story of you going to New Mexico to meet a woman who gives you a book recommendation. You could have done that over the phone, I think.
You know, desperation. You get on a plane, go meet her.
So talk about that, the book and where it led you.
Well, you know, somebody, a guitar player, told me that she knew a New Mexican healing woman who worked with Bob Dylan during his divorce with Sarah, the mother of his children. And she would meet with me. And so I was in so much pain, I'd have walked naked down I-35 if they said it would help. So I got on a plane and went and met her. And I talked for just a few minutes, and she summed it up and sent me to Barnes & Noble's and told me to get a book called The Sociopath Next Door. I got the book and read it on the plane home, started it on the plane home, and boom, I was in relationships with a series of sociopaths. And it happened because of my woundedness. I wasn't able to keep myself safe. I didn't know safety, and danger was familiar. So it was the beginning of understanding what I was doing to draw this pain into my life. She really helped me. The book really helped me. It was written by a Harvard psychiatrist educator who teaches up-and-coming psychologist, psychiatrist at Harvard University. And it's still a bestseller because it's real good. It explains sociopathy and explains what to do if you find yourself in a relationship with one. Basically, the message, I'll give away the secret. Run!
Right. Well, and there's a second book that also took this farther for you, which was Nancy Verrier's The Primal Sound, Understanding the Adopted Child.
Yeah, the primal wound. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Verrier wrote a thesis for her PhD called The Primal Wound, and then expanded it into a book that still explains adoptees to themselves. We experienced a primal wound. We were separated from our family. And even though we got a new family, that separation left a deep trauma.
Yeah.
And pretending like it didn't doesn't make it go away.
No, and you had to explore that.
I had to explore it.
And did you? You said you're friends with Bessel van der Kolk.
Yeah, Bessel's a good friend of mine. He's a trauma expert. He's had a bestseller forever on Amazon called "The Body Keeps the Score."
Yeah,
I've worked with him as a client, a friend, and then I've taught with him at retreat centers. He's worked with a lot of, and still does, with a lot of people in the healing professions. And I've worked with him through songwriting with soldiers, and also writing songs with some of his, I don't know what you'd call it, participants in his workshop, yeah. Who carry a heavy trauma load. Yeah, Bessel's a good friend, and I really, really like where he's coming from.
Yeah, I became familiar with his work. My wife and I, we lost our 17-year-old daughter to cancer 2 years ago.
Oh, God, and I'm so sorry.
There's trauma. And I did not, did not know about it. And so someone sent me that book. And actually, there's a section at the end that talks about work he's done with improvisers, where that, you know, because you can find joy in improv, you find connection, which is hugely important in this book and true of the human condition. And that essence of how, you know, you can kind of work on healing your mind, but if it's not also in your body, and there's so much in your book about that, of like needing to get this thing deep. And that's the work that we've been doing. And, you know, it's like, and my wife just tried grief yoga for the first time, which she really enjoyed and thought it was like a good process. It's interesting because there's a quote, you quote him in the book where he says, quote, "The opposite of trauma is communication."
Isn't that beautiful?
It's beautiful. And it's what you're saying. Yes, the well of this stuff is sad, but it's also connected to other people. And then when you can show up for other people who are in pain, that's a gift. And that's the work you've been able to do.
Yeah, I think that's the hope and the goal of healing, mm-hmm. is to reconnect yourself to yourself. I mean, Bessel explained it perfectly, that healing around trauma becomes, you know what you know, you see what you see, you feel what you feel, and you don't need to have a vote taken as to who you are. You got that. You know what you know, you see what you see, you feel what you feel. Deeply traumatized people have struggled with that, knowing what we know, seeing what we see, feeling what we feel. Once you're able to know what you know, see what you see, feel what you feel, the goal then becomes to help those who are struggling with those things, who have dealt with or have been dealt terrible trauma. Trauma messes us up a lot, and I think that, you know, Bessel says it's the root cause of what's wrong today.
Oh, I believe that. I mean, if something like what happened to my wife Hannah and I happened when I was in my 20s, I don't know that I would have the gift of it happening in my 50s when I've got large community and have, you know, a certain sort of, you know, I've gone through my shit, you know, and so again, not easy, but. You know, we're still standing. The worst thing happened to me in the world, and I'm still standing. So that's you know, a way to move forward. I want to talk a bit about healing. There's a longish passage, but I think it's really beautiful. And I want to read it from the book. You say, quote, "The road home is paved in human connection, and it happens in small and safe communities where you know you are not alone. Turns out this is what songs do best. They show our insides on the outside, reveal secrets, and demonstrate that we humans are more or less all in the same boat. Being witnessed in all our vulnerability locks in a new connection to self and others." Wow, you nailed that.
I have great teachers. I have great teachers. Yes, and once we are connected to each other, it's still hard, but it's not impossible. What's impossible is the hopelessness of utter disconnection.
Hmm. Yeah.
We need each other. We are like schools of fish or herds of deer. We need each other. We don't want to need each other. Yeah, especially as Americans, we believe in the great individual, rugged individualism. Into that myth, we all dive at our own peril. We do need each other. We need each other in a primal, deeply embedded way that we can't extricate. You know, if we try to change that, we turn into Ted Kaczynski. We go crazy. We need each other. And so reconnecting is the point. And I think the arts are where we can find each other.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard right now, right? Because, you know, I'm sure we share a similar political agenda. And this country, I see this happening on both sides, where people don't want to come together to try to solve anything together. But I, at the end of the day, we can't do this alone.
We can't. And one of the great things, my experience working with Songwriting with Soldiers, is politics is off the table.
Right.
We go through a whole retreat and never talk about politics. We don't talk about beliefs. Beliefs are useless when you're dying from war trauma. When right. you have PTSD and you can't breathe at night, when you can't catch your breath, when a balloon pops and you hit the deck and start screaming, who cares what you believe? So beliefs are off the table. What we talk about is story and feelings, and that's where we can find each other. As soon as we go into beliefs, we're going to argue.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk us through one of your songs, and it's probably your most famous song, which is Mercy Now. And Rolling Stone named it one of the top 20 saddest songs of all time, but you don't think it's really sad, right?
I don't think it's sad at all. I think it's real.
Yeah.
I think we live in an escapist culture that equates real with happy, mm-hmm. You know, and sad is to be avoided. I think it's real important to be authentic and vulnerable and write truth. So there's a struggle in the song, but the song is not fundamentally sad. It is fundamentally true. And there's hope. There's so much hope in that song. If it makes people cry, and it does, that doesn't mean that there's no hope or that there's something about it that is to be avoided. It just opens up the heart chakra because it's a recitation of all of our vulnerability.
Yeah, and it started with your dad and then spun out from there, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think the big idea behind the song is that if we demand justice, we have to be careful. Because certainly as an addict and an alcoholic, if I were given what I truly deserved based on many of the behaviors I've exhibited, I'd be dead.
Yeah.
I've been given mercy and grace. And that makes you think twice when you scream for less than that for other people.
Yeah. I was also curious, you did EMDR therapy.
I did. EMDR really helped me.
Yeah, talk about that, because that this is a thing, and I don't think people know about it.
Yeah, EMDR was developed, I think, by the military. It is impossible to explain. They send little pings into your ears through headphones. It's done a couple of ways, mm-hmm. but basically it's a way of working through trauma without having to talk about your trauma. Yeah. It's done through sound. Mm-hmm. The way I did it was to talk some about my dad and had me visualize a reunion with my dad who's passed on. And there's some visualization going on. But EMDR really was helpful to me, and I used it quite a bit to some success when I was in that treatment center.
Hmm. All right. In a moment, I'm going to ask you for your yes and story, which is how we always end the podcast. But before we do that, I'm curious, did you ever second guess telling these stories out loud, or was this always just the path that it was going to go and you were going to share it all?
No, I mean, I didn't know these all. I wanted to write an interesting book, mm-hmm. and I knew that I had to have a through line. And so if I'm going to call a book Saved by a Song, I need to qualify what I'm being saved from. And so the story ends up, you're saved from yourself. Congratulations. I have so many self-destructive impulses, and I have done so many things ass backwards in my life. I really didn't intend to tell the story of it all the way it ended up, but that's the best way to tell it. And if you listen to my music, it's all there anyway. I mean, if you listen to the songs up until most recently, every one of them's about how hard love is and how I fail over and over again. So mm-hmm. inevitably, that person who writes those songs probably has a problem with codependency and love and sex addiction. And I do. And I dealt with it through the help of others and therapy and a treatment center. I stayed single 5 years, and now I'm in a relationship that works. I did the work. Mm. So I think the story is sort of, here's the story, here's the work, and here's the result. So I'm not ashamed of my story, and I don't feel as though I need to hide behind sort of niceties. If my story can be helpful to others, that's the hope, is that it's helpful to others rather than just exhibitionism.
Right. No, and that definitely comes through. All right, so we always have the podcast asking for a yes and story, and we were talking about this before about how human beings tend to say no or just don't do anything. I know the whole book is a yes and story, as I mentioned to you before, but do you have anything that you want to share that's akin to that?
Yeah, one of the craziest yes ands of my life that led to a deep, deep healing for me was I played a show in New Orleans at the Ogden Museum of Southern Art after Katrina. Mm-hmm. And it was very well received, and I had a wonderful experience, and the museum director took me to lunch the next day. And for some reason on stage, I said, you know, I was adopted from New Orleans. I spent the first year of my life at a place here called St. Vincent's. Mm-hmm. But I never, ever thought of St. Vincent's as an actual place. It was a story told to me as a child,
right.
Kind of like Pinocchio or something, Bambi or, I don't know, Donald Duck. It wasn't a place. In my mind, even though I was an adult, it never occurred to me that it was a place that existed. I said that because I was giving the audience credentials that I am from New Orleans.
Yeah.
Well, the museum director was bringing me to lunch, and she said, hey, Mary, St. Vincent's is right up the street across from where we're going to lunch. You want to see it? And it was like, oh, my God, my stomach lurched. And everything in me wanted to say, I don't think so. But I just kind of nodded, okay. And we pulled up, and it was a rundown rooming house. But you could see that it was a mighty Catholic institution at one point. And as we walked up those stairs, it hit me that was the stairs my pregnant mother walked up with me inside her. And that was the stairs she walked down without me. And I never saw her again. It was chilling. It was terrifying. And it was important because it led me to the road to start to ask about my story, which helped fill in the gaps. I had trouble at night. I was falling through space every night, like falling through space, untethered, just free falling. It was terrifying. It's because I didn't have roots. My tree didn't have roots. And it began the root growing process when I said yes to going into that haunted place.
I love it. The book is called Saved by Song, The Art and Healing Power of Songwriting. Mary Gaucher, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Kelly. And I'm so sorry about the loss of your daughter.
Thank you, Mary.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is L.F. Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Feet. survive.
From the dungeon, no one survives.